Here is a special announcement. Today is Tuesday, and not, as is announced in today's Sunday Telegraph, Friday. And now, a repeat of last Thursday's performance of Monday Night is Music Night.
And after that special introduction to Vivaldi's Winterlago, taken from a private eye recording, we now make the switch over from the dynamic Kipper the Cat crew via the news and the news feature to this evening's Evening Under Lamplight. This is, as you well know, Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. And I am, as you may also know, Robert Louis Abrahamson, your host. Let me take a few seconds to remind you that the archives of our shows are on SoundCloud and on our website, momentsunderlamplight.co.uk. And you can get in touch with me at rla@momentsunderlamplight.co.uk or lamplight@cambridge105.fm. And I needn't remind you that, as always, you are invited to attend. I'm calling this show Drama or Nothing. That's part of a passage from Robert Frost that I want to center the show around. Here's the passage. Everything written is as good as it is dramatic. It need not declare itself in form, but it is drama or nothing. By whom, where, and when is the question. That was written in Frost's preface to his play A Way Out in 1929. It gives us a lot to think about and I think can open up some fascinating and rewarding ways of attending to almost everything we encounter. But two items first before we move into our main theme. Last week, the Daily Doo-Wop announced what they called the passing of Lee Andrews, aged 79. Who was Lee Andrews, you ask? You remember the few times I've played a track by Lee Andrews and the Hearts, a Philadelphia doo-wop group, mostly from the 50s, though many of their songs were reissued in the 60s with minor acclaim, but with great renown in Philadelphia, perhaps mostly because they had the sense to hire as their managers a succession of Philadelphia disc jockeys, who then ensured that the records would be played on at least one of the local radio stations. Lee Andrews and the Hearts were not great, and my sense is that Lee Andrews himself knew this well. But they are part of the heritage Philadelphia hands on to the world, and thus they are celebrated here on The Voice of Philadelphia Chauvinism in the Heart of Cambridge. We were talking last time about the Four Seasons songs of passive-aggressive self-pity, songs in which, for instance, the singer makes sure the girl feels sorry for him after she's dumped him. I don't think there's any self-pity in the Lee Andrews songs, but there's a lot of sorrow and longing. Just run down a list of their titles. Teardrops. Long Lonely Nights. Try the Impossible. Maybe You'll Be There. Why Do I... All I Ask Is Love. Baby, Come Back. Lonely Room. No, I'm not finished. I Cried, followed by I've Got the Right to Cry. Nobody's Home, and I Miss You So. There are, of course, other songs on their list more upbeat, but you'll have to admit that these are a lot of sad songs. Here's one of them, Maybe You'll Be There, first released in 1954 while the group was still in high school. Unfortunately, the nationally popular Orioles also released this song at that time, so the Lee Andrews version attracted attention only in Philadelphia. You said your arms would always hold me. You said your lips were mine alone to kiss. Well, after all those things you told me, how could it end like this? He's not, I think, trying to make her feel guilty, but just to express his pained puzzlement. If anything, he's really too caught up in his misery to try to make her feel guilty. He's like a ghost going through the crowded avenue, hoping maybe you'll be there. Someday he dreams his prayers might be answered. Notice the little flourishes by the non-singing pianist of the group, Kenny Lowe. If you have a liking for old doo-wop music, you'll be interested in hearing this. If you don't have a liking for it, you'll nevertheless find it interesting for historical reasons.
Each time I see a crowd of people, just like a fool, I stop and stare. I know it's not the proper thing to do, and maybe you'll be there.
Maybe you'll be there.
I go out walking at the midnight along a lonely thoroughfare. It's not the time or place to look for you. Said your arms always hold me. You said your lips were mine alone to kiss. Well, after all those things you told me, how could it end like this?
Could it end like this?
I'll hear a footstep on the stairs. With anxious thoughts, I'll hurry to the door. And maybe you'll be there. You said your arms and yours would always hold me. Well, you said your lips were mine alone, long to kiss. And after all the many things, yes, you've told me. How could it end like this?
Could it end like this?
Someday when all my prayers are answered, I'll hear a footstep on the stairs. With anxious thoughts, I'll hurry to the door, and maybe you'll be there.
Lee Andrews and the Hearts, Maybe You'll Be There, doo-wop from 1954. Here's one more before we leave this. One more because, well, it seems to me you'll never hear these songs again, unless Greg should play them on Kipper the Cat sometime. But I want to invite us to attend to the song called The Clock, another song about longing for his baby, who's been gone on some distant trip, perhaps, for 24 hours. The clock keeps ticking away the time, and he still hasn't heard from her. Well, I long to hear my baby, but all I ever hear is tick, tick, tock, ticking of the clock. And then the alarm rings again, driving him insane. Now, to tie in with our theme of drama or nothing, this song features a few little dramas. Nothing to brag about, but there's something going on. The Hearts, the backup group, start calling, "Hey, Lee, you're wanted on the phone." "Well, if it's not my baby, then I'm not at home." And then, "Oops, is that the front door?" And the Hearts answer, "No. Darn it, it can only be the clock." And then a wild sax solo. As I say, not great stuff, but lively and worth giving a little tribute to. So here's the clock. Do you remember when clocks actually used to go tick-tock?
Tick-tick-tock,
will somebody make it stop? Well,
tick-tick-tock,
then know the noisy clock. Well, I long to hear my baby, but all I ever hear is
tick-tick-tock, tick another clock, ring, ring, ring.
There goes that alarm again. Well,
ring, 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 ring.
That thing driving me insane. Well, I long to have my baby, but all I ever hear is somebody call my name. It's somebody playing a game. Well, if it's not my baby, then I'm not at home. I just sit here and listen to the ticking of the clock.
It's
been 24 hours away from me. You know I'm gone for my baby. Oh, where can she be? Is that the front door?
No,
no, then it could only be the clock.
And from Lee Andrews and the Hearts, let's move to something more current. I mentioned a few weeks ago, when I played the song called Mother, that Louis Barabbas is coming to perform in Cambridge, and this is the week he'll be here. To be specific, this coming Friday, the 25th, at 7:30 at Hot Numbers, that wonderful cafe just down the street from us here on Guider Street, a few doors down from Mill Road. Here's the promotional announcement Louis has put out for his current tour. Louis Barabbas is a writer, performer, and label director, best known for caustic love songs and energetic stage shows. Over the years, he has performed all over the world, from Mexico and the USA to mainland Europe and Australia, sharing stages with such disparate acts as Motorhead, Supergrass, Sun Ra's Orchestra, and the Blockheads. He is also a committee member at the Musicians Union, on the advisory board for Unconvention, presenter on Fab Radio International, moderator for Tom Robinson's Fresh on the Net, occasional Spoons player, one-time beard model, co-founder of Debt Records, and captain of dirt swing band The Bedlam Six. BBC Six Music once described Louis' music as excellent in every way, but there's probably still room for improvement. The album Louis is promoting is his first solo album, cheerfully entitled gentle songs of ceaseless horror. There are, for instance, songs sung by someone who died the night before her wedding, and another about her wedding dress now hanging on a scarecrow. The love songs are bitter melancholy, and underneath it all is some kind of fierce struggle to throw aside religious strictures that dictate and confine, preferring the pain of a bleak life instead. Very gentle, but as gothic as you'd want. But in a sense, not entirely horrific, since the wit and versatile performance never let us completely surrender to the sentimentality of gothic horror. Here's a taste of one verse from the song One Tiny Taste. We're all formed in the forge of the rotten parts of heaven, without ever being told what we're designed to be. And it looked like it took a lot of time to learn all those lessons, but now time won't learn any from me. Because I dreamt of a day when fate lost its teeth, and on pillows we lay with them hidden underneath. You can get lost in the quick succession of paradoxes and images, but their effect is cumulative. And most effective, I think, is Louis's voice, ranging from gentle and soothing to frighteningly hostile. There's the gentle songs of ceaseless horror. It was hard for me to decide which track to play for us this evening under lamplight. There are 14 tracks on the album, lasting almost 45 minutes. Quite a generous package, especially since Debt Records is an ethical company that invites you to pay what you can afford. There's a recommended minimum, but you can pay that or pay more or pay less if that's your choice. Go to Debt Records, one word, debtrecords.net to find out more. Let's listen to that song about the wedding dress on the scarecrow. I'll give you the lyrics first. You'll then have a foretaste of what's going on, so that when you hear the words actually performed, you'll be more attentive to the performance itself and its effect upon you. It's amazing here how the conventionally idyllic country setting is transformed into something horrific, but at the same time, I think, it also transforms the horror into something peacefully idyllic. On my wedding day, they only rang a single bell. No witness came. You had me all to yourself. A willow veil and gown of long leaf pine instead of lace. An embroidered train endowed with twines of every muted shade. On my wedding day, fronds of fern were flower girls, their dresses frayed, and the rice replaced with earth. Love was my only journey until the dark swallowed me whole. Now no one will return me to your door. On my wedding day, limbs of trees strained to receive forget-me-not bouquets, though many called them wreaths. But of all the seasons, winter always tells the fewest lies, and on snowy days I'll surely fade neath folds of bridal white. Can a love start in a bloodless heart? Can it shelter my life in its shade? Will no one tell me why I was fated to die the night before my wedding day? On my wedding night, beneath a waning moon, I lay still as an ammonite with thick coverings overlaid. I dreamed we'd been surrounded by peacock broods and damsel flies, with lilies pressed upon my breast and silver in my eyes. On my wedding night, I lingered long but lay alone, no hint of morning light and no dew upon the lawn. There's a wilderness within these walls, this box of cold unanswered calls. Desire lives on and survives the form, though we'll never feel the dawn. Now my wedding gown is on a scarecrow in a field. Won't you take it down and lay it by my grave concealed? Of all the seasons, winter always tells the fewest lies, and on snowy days I'll surely fade beneath the folds of bridal white.
On my wedding day, they only rang one single bell. No witness came. You had me all to yourself.
A willow veil and gown of longleaf pine instead of lace, an embroidered train endowed with twines of every muted shade.
On my wedding day, fronds of fern were flower girls, their dresses frayed, and rice replaced with earth. Love was my only journey until the dark swallowed me whole. Now no one will return me to your door. On my wedding day, limbs of trees strained to receive forget-me-not bouquet, though many called to wreath. Of all the seasons, winter always tells the fewest lies, and on snowy days I'll surely fade neath folds of bridal white. Can a love start in a bloodless heart shelter my life in its shade? Will no one tell me why I was fated to die the night for my beneath a waning moon I lay, still as an ammonite, with thick coverings overlaid. I dream we'd been surrounded by peacock broods and damselflies, with lilies pressed on my breast and silver in my eyes. On my wedding night I lingered long but alone, no hint of morning light, and no dew upon the lawn. There's a wilderness within these walls, this box of cold, unanswered calls. Desire lives on, survives the form, though we'll never feel this dawn. Can a love start in a bloodless heart shelter my life in shame? Will no one tell me why I was fated to die the night for my wedding? On a scarecrow in a field, won't you take it down? Lay it by my grave, concealed. Of all the seasons, winter always tells the fewest lies, and on snowy days I'll surely fade neath folds of bridal white. Can a love start in a bloodless heart shelter my life in shame? Will no one tell me why I was fated to die that night? Can a love start in a bloodless heart can shelter my life in its shame? Will no one tell me why I was fated to die tonight for my wedding day?
Well, that was Louis Barabbas' Scarecrow. Go and hear him at Hot Numbers this Friday, March 25th at 7:30. Admission is free, though you're welcome to leave a donation, of course. Louis puts on a great show, and there have been very excited reviews of his tour so far. See you there. And see you here now, as we are joined together this evening under lamplight, you and me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, here, now, on Cambridge 105. And now back to Robert Frost on literature as drama. Here is the passage again. Everything written is as good as it is dramatic. It need not declare itself in form, but it is drama or nothing. By whom, where, and when is the question. Not just everything written, but actually all life is dramatic, that is, interactive. All life takes place in a context that we either do or do not interact with. We looked last time at Whitman's line, "Whoever walks a furlong without sympathy walks to his own funeral dressed in his shroud." Here's what I said then. When Whitman speaks about walking with sympathy, he means our openness to all things, feeling with them, or better, resonating with them, turning my quivering nerves in their direction, my energy projection in tune with their energy projections. If we walk around without this sympathy, we are isolated from all the life around us. We can use the people and things around us, but we cannot interact with them. We might as well be dead, and thus Whitman shows the man walking without sympathy as walking to his own funeral. I used a lot of different terms there, connecting sympathy with openness to all things, feeling with them, resonating with them. Another way to speak about that sympathy, of course, is to say that we are part of a drama, interconnected in a complex dramatic plot line. We can miss our cue or we can sit on the sidelines, but we cannot leave the stage, can we? Or rather, we can leave the stage, but then we are exiting to walk to our own funeral. And walking to our own funerals is not so rare, I'm afraid. It seems to be becoming more and more common, at least if we think about it, the way Wendell Berry suggests in an essay from as far back as 1978. But it seems more and more relevant in the years since then. The essay is called Home of the Free, and we're going to take a diversion from Robert Frost to spend a minute attending to this essay. Berry is talking here about the problems of automation, or more basically, the problem of trying to avoid the harder tasks of life, which ends up to be a denial of life itself, walking to one's own funeral, as it were. The essay begins with Berry in 1978, looking far into the future, to the year 2001. I'll read you part of the essay. I was writing not long ago about a team of Purdue engineers who foresaw that by 2001, practically everything would be done by remote control. The question I asked, because such a projection forces one to ask it, was, where does satisfaction come from? I concluded that there probably wouldn't be much satisfaction in such a world. There would be a lot of what passes for efficiency, a lot of production and consumption, but little satisfaction. What I failed to acknowledge was that this world of the future is already established among us and is growing. Two advertisements that I have lately received from correspondents make this clear and raise the question about the sources of satisfaction more immediately and urgently than any abstract projection can do. The first is the legend from a John Deere display at Waterloo Municipal Airport. John Deere, as you know, by the way, makes tractors. Introducing SoundGuard Body, a down-to-earth space capsule. New SoundGuard Body from John Deere, an Earth space capsule to protect and encourage the American farmer at his job of being breadwinner to the world of families. Outside, dust, noise, heat, storm, fumes. Inside, all's quiet, comfortable, safe. Features include a four-post roll guard, space-aged metals, plastics and fibers to isolate driver from noise, vibration and jolts. He dials inside weather to his liking. He push buttons radio or stereo tape entertainment. He breathes filtered, conditioned air in his pressurized compartment. He has remote control over multi-ton and multi-hookups with control tower visibility from his scientifically padded seat. The second is an ad for a condominium housing development. Home of the free. We do the things you hate. You do the things you like. We mow the lawn, shovel the walks, paint and repair and do all exterior maintenance. You cross-country ski, play tennis, hike, swim, work out, read or nap. Or advise our permanent maintenance staff as they do the things you hate. Different as they may seem at first, these two ads make the same appeal, and they represent two aspects of the same problem. The widespread and still spreading assumption that we are somehow have the right to be set free from anything whatsoever that we hate or don't want to do. According to this view, what we want to be set free from are the natural conditions of the world and the necessary work of human life. We do not want to experience temperatures that are the least bit too hot or too cold, or to work in the sun, or to be exposed to wind or rain, or come in personal contact with anything describable as dirt, or provide for any of our own needs, or clean up after ourselves. Implicit in all this is the desire to be free of the hassles of mortality, to be safe from the life cycle. Such freedom and safety are always for sale. It is proposed that if we put all earthly obligations and the rites of passage into the charge of experts and machines, then life will become a permanent holiday. What these people are really selling is insulation, cushions of technology, space-age materials, and the menial work of other people, to keep fantasy in and reality out. The condominium ad says flat out that it is addressed to people who hate the handwork of household maintenance and who will enjoy advising the people who do it for them. It is addressed, in other words, to those who think themselves too good to do work that other people are not too good to do. But it is a little surprising to realize that the John Deere ad is addressed to farmers, who not only hate farming, that is, any physical contact with the ground, or the weather, or the crops, but also hate tractors, from the dust, fumes, noise, vibrations, and jolts of which they wish to be protected by an Earth space capsule and a scientifically padded seat. Of course, the only real way to get this sort of freedom and safety, to escape the hassles of earthly life, is to die. And what I think we see in these advertisements is an appeal to a desire to be dead that is evidently felt by many people. These ads are addressed to the perfect consumers, the self-consumers who have found nothing of interest here on earth, nothing to do, and are impatient to be shed of earthly concerns. And so I am at a loss to explain the delay. Why hasn't some super salesman sold every one of these people a coffin, an earth-space capsule, in which they would experience no discomfort or inconvenience whatsoever, would have to do no work that they hate, would be spared all extremes of weather and all noises, fumes, vibrations, and jolts?
I've nothing left to say, but I'm gonna say it anyway. And I hear the people say, why won't he go away? I pass the houses of the dead. They call me to join their group, but I stagger on instead. Dear God, sweet God, protect me from the truth. Hey, I'm dead.
There we had Randy Newman, I'm Dead But I Don't Know It. He's talking, ironically of course, about his career as a performer. He doesn't know that it's time to quit. As a performer he's dead, but he doesn't know it. Just like these farmers who want a John Deere Earth space capsule to protect them from the discomforts of life. They're dead, as Wendell Berry defines it, but they don't know it. Or to return to Robert Frost's terms, they reject the drama of life, the interaction with all aspects, and as Berry insists, this drama includes a certain amount of pain or discomfort. It's part of being alive. Randy Newman, singer here, avoids the pain of creating new material, and so produces each new album just like the previous one, only not as good. There's no play anymore. No play, no drama, no life. And before we get back onto track, let me go off on yet another diversion, this time taking us to my favourite Dead poem. It's a poem, actually, about blindness. Now, blindness is a serious subject, but there are ways and ways of treating it. The most serious moral issues we were taught at Amherst College, where Robert Frost, formerly our resident poet, was very much present, had to do not with actions but words. How do we talk about something? What sort of drama are we speaking out of? And how well do we articulate this drama? Is our voice appropriate in tone and style to the situation? Well, here's a poem that illustrates, according to this Amherst morality, an immoral way of speaking about blindness. There is no dramatic engagement. William McGonagall's poem, The Sorrows of the Blind, is a really bad poem. In fact, McGonagall, self-styled poet and tragedian of Dundee, was known as the best bad verse writer in Victorian Britain. He wants to write a poem raising our sympathy for the blind, but he does so in simplistic, cliched, platitudinous language. His focus, in other words, is on the sentiment we should feel about blindness, not on interacting with the topic of blindness and speaking from a true or fresh engagement with the topic. He's under the impression that all he has to do is somehow make sure that every pair of lines rhymes, no matter how badly the meter comes out. We therefore laugh at the poem and feel bad that we may be laughing at blind people, but we're not. Laughing at this poem is a way of taking blindness seriously and dismissing stupid ways of speaking about it. I'll read it, and you can see what I mean. Pity the sorrows of the poor blind, for they can but little comfort find. As they walk along the street, they know not where to put their feet. They are deprived of that earthly joy of seeing either man, woman, or boy. Sad and lonely through the world they go, not knowing a friend from a foe, nor the difference betwixt day and night, for the want of their eyesight. Excuse me a second, may I just remark that you cannot end a line with a two-stress word like eyesight, especially if the two syllables have the same vowel sound. It makes the line thud. But notice that this does not stop McGonagall from doing it several times in the poem. The blind mother cannot see her darling boy that was once her soul's joy, by day and night, since she lost her precious sight. To her the world seems dark and drear, and she can find no comfort here. She once found pleasure in reading books, but now pale and careworn are her looks. Since she has lost her eyesight, everything seems wrong and nothing right. The face of nature, with all its beauties and livery green, appears to the blind just like a dream. All things beautiful have vanished from their sight, which were once their heart's delight. The blind father cannot see his beautiful child, nor wife. That was once the joy of his life, that he was wont to see at morn and night, when he had his eyesight. All comfort has vanished from him now, and a dejected look hangs on his brow. Kind Christians all, both great and small, pity the sorrows of the blind, they can but little comfort find. Therefore we ought to be content with our lot, and for the eyesight we have got, and pray to God both day and night to preserve our eyesight. To be always willing to help the blind in their distress, and the Lord will surely bless and guard us by night and day, and remember us at the judgment day. That was William McGonagall, self-proclaimed poet and tragedian, Bard of Dundee, followed by Taj Mahal and Blind Boy Rag. Now back again to Frost. Everything written is as good as it is dramatic. By whom, where, and when is the question. That means we judge the quality of a piece of writing not by its content, as literalists do, but as sophisticated readers We judge it according to how dramatic it is, how close it comes to the dramatic interactions we recognize as essential to life, how close to the qualities of a voice coming to us from a specific dramatic context. I had a friend who wrote his PhD thesis late in life about sports writing as literature. This meant he looked at articles on the sports pages not for what they told us about the sporting event they were reporting, but for how they told us, what voice the writer adopted, how the writer interacted with what other sports writers had done. That means how the writer played with the conventions of this type of writing. And the drama between writer and reader, how the writer played on our expectations and passions. Or think how radio shows are dramatic. Not just bringing you news or playing you music, but how the presenters are dramatic. Look, for instance, at Kipper the Cat, which is on the air just before us on Evening Under Lamplight. Greg and company play old vinyl recordings, and people from all over the world listen to the show. But are they listening just to hear the old records, or learn a few more facts about when the records were recorded, or who was playing the piano on the track, or whatever? Yeah, of course, to some extent, but I suspect that if you asked them, they'd say what they really like about the show is the drama. That is, the voice of Greg rising and falling in his excitement, fading out a little as he turns from the mic to adjust the arm of the turntable, showing us that he really is speaking to us while performing an action for our pleasure. And most of all, perhaps, the little drama in the studio as Greg and Tony and Darren interact with each other. I was going to talk about political speeches here, but I don't think there's time. Just keep in mind the way Donald Trump rejects any kind of dramatic interaction with people who oppose him, contrasted to the way Barack Obama seems always ready to attend to hecklers or other opponents, listening carefully, replying thoughtfully, never pushing his ideas, only presenting them. That's why many Republicans don't respect him. He's not confrontational enough. But the real point, at least as we're looking at it here this evening under lamplight, is that Obama is alive in a way that, say, Donald Trump is not. I'm just saying. But now we've left ourselves very little time to attend to Walt Whitman and the drama of his poetry. Chant 49, our reading for this evening, begins in a very dramatic way with this mythic Whitman persona turning to address death, perhaps the most dramatic line out of all the 1,335 lines of Song of Myself. In the previous chant, he had said, "No array of terms can say how much I am at peace about God and about death." And now he states this in a different kind of drama, direct address. "As to you, death, and you, bitter hug of mortality, it is idle to try to alarm me." There's that defiant Whitman, standing his ground, superior even to death, or the fear of death. And then a shift from the bold boast to a little dramatic scene, with Whitman, like Alfred Hitchcock, appearing on the sidelines of the scene. It's a scene not of death, but of new life. And that is what reassures Whitman that death is not final. There's always new life. And the corpse, Whitman says, makes good manure, which produces new plant life. "To his work without flinching, the accoucheur," that is the midwife, "comes. I see the elder hand pressing, receiving, supporting. I recline by the sills of the exquisite flexible doors and mark the outlet and mark the relief and escape. And as to you, corpse, I think you are good manure, and that does not offend me. I smell the white roses, sweet-scented and growing. I reach to the leafy lips. I reach to the polished breasts of melons. And as to you, life, I reckon you are the leavings of many deaths. No doubt I have died myself 10,000 times before." And then comes a very puzzling section as Whitman now turns and responds to the whispering of the heavens, which teach a lesson about the relative value of good and evil, light and darkness. Whitman looks at a night scene under the moon, at the decay and muck, and the moaning gibberish of the dry limbs. He acknowledges these dark things in life, but then he knows to ascend from the moon, from the night, and remember that this ghastly glitter under the moon is only sunlight reflected. It all comes from the life-producing, steady and central sun. Let's hear these concluding lines. I hear you whispering there, O stars of heaven, O suns, O grass of graves, O perpetual transfers and promotions. If you do not say anything, how can I say anything? Of the turbid pool that lies in the autumn forest, of the moon that descends the steeps of the soughing twilight, toss sparkles of day and dusk, toss on the black stems that decay in the muck, toss to the moaning gibberish of the dry limbs. I ascend from the moon, I ascend from the night, and perceive of the ghastly glitter the sunbeams reflected, and debouch to the steady and central from the offspring great or small. The Beatles' Sun King resonating to the energy of those steady and central sunbeams, outshining the darkness which comprehended it not. We've had several digressions from our theme of drama or nothing. And there's so much more I want to say about this topic. Let's see if we can have a kind of sequel next time and look more at this important theme. Important because it describes what we encounter all the time. So come back next time, in a fortnight, that is, April 5th. You've been listening to, and I'm very grateful to you for listening to, Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, at lamplight@cambridge105.fm. And so, from all of us here, there's only me in the studio, but I'll pretend I'm all of us here. Good night. And see you next time. And in keeping with the loose threads of our theme about drama that we've left dangling, let's go out with my classmate Michael Brecker's Loose Threads from his album Pilgrimage.
Thank you.